From the North Carolina Reading Service, it's the Indie Week. Read for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners today, John Federson covers the issue of Indie Week, dated July the 29th from 2020. And our beautiful music today is actually from in-house. It's offered by our own NCRS Tuba and Euphonium Choir. They provided today's music, and they, for special this broadcast, included an Ophicleide and a serpent in the group today. Thanks, folks. We're proud of our talented musicians on our own radio staff. And there they go. Now on to business, and from Carrie, here's an article, short article, about Jason Cirioli. And this is a 15-minute article that I rarely read, but it's in, he's a beekeeper, and Sarah Pequeno has written this question and answer for Jason Cirioli. How did you get started in beekeeping? He says, I used to run my own landscape service, installation, maintenance. One of my customers was the pastor emeritus from our church, a good family friend. He had a really tiny yard that we maintained, but he had bees. And I said, instead of me charging you, Dr. Brewer, so much to do maintenance, why don't you just show me what's going on with the bees? So every week or two, we'd go by there. We talked about different stuff, and eventually he caught a swarm of bees, which is when a hive actually divides itself and tries to relocate. Caught one, put them in a box, and told me to come pick them up. So that's how I got my first beehive. Why beekeeping instead of other homesteading efforts? It's not like having chickens where you have to have a crop. I'm sorry, you have to have a coop. You just have a little small box that's full of bees, and they just sort of go do their thing. So it's a lot more hands-off, in my experience, at least when it's just a couple of beehives. So it was partly because I'm lazy, don't want to really work hard, but I was interested in working with my friend, Dr. Brewer, and it just worked out. As soon as we got into it, I was totally fascinated by all the different nuances about the bees and what they did and how they worked as a colony. I already appreciated the flowers and all that kind of stuff, but it was neat to see what they went to and what different blooms they liked. It got me more involved in understanding the cycle of how everything works together in nature. It's just a fascinating thing. I wouldn't say I'm good at it by any means, but I was able to stick with it and have a lot of success. It turned into a business. When I approached Garden Supply, they were not doing bees at all. We now have a full shop for beekeepers to come get all the materials that they need. We sell bees. We sell queens. We do everything. Question. You said you previously had hives in downtown Apex. Is this something that people living in more urban parts of the Triangle can do? Absolutely. That's one of the key reasons I was able to approach Garden Supply and say, this is a viable business option. We can help support the communities, help support beekeepers, because there is that need. So, absolutely. Within a quarter mile of my house, and I'm almost in downtown Apex, I could probably point out 5 or 6 people that have beehives. They're really all over. Any final thoughts? There are plenty of ways to support pollinators, support your environment. You'd be surprised once you stop using some of the mosquito control companies, some of the harsher sprays for bugs around your house, what a diverse environment will emerge. That can worry people sometimes. They don't want the bugs. But you can stay supportive of pollinators and bees in lots of different ways. And moving across the page, the good, the bad, and the awful awards this week. Good. The arts live on. Raleigh Little Theater opened its first online-only show this week with She Kills Monsters. Outer Banks, the record-breaking Netflix original series set in a campy teen drama version of North Carolina, was picked up for a second season this weekend. Taylor Swift released new music, sure, but so did local acts like M8 Ala, Libby Rodenbaugh, and Sylvan Esso. There are more local projects and releases than we can count, and that's exactly the point. The Triangle's arts scene is still as vibrant as ever, providing much-needed light and inspiration to an overwhelming world. More good news. You can be a part of that work by donating to an artist relief fund, becoming an arts sustainer, and buying tickets for their online events. For the BAD Award, we have university reopenings. As we said last week, there aren't any great options for reopening schools during a global pandemic. That doesn't mean the steps being taken by area universities aren't bad. UNC's Board of Governors announced Thursday that students won't see tuition or fee decreases, even during a highly limited online-only semester. Duke announced Sunday that on-campus housing will be available only to first and second year students in the fall, which has left thousands of upperclassmen scrambling to find somewhere to live just 3 weeks out from the first day of classes. There's also bad news for campus employees. The UNC system asked campuses to submit plans for potential budget cuts of up to 50%. And their awful award goes to Town Hall Hackers. On Sunday, the Northern Orange NAACP held a virtual town hall to discuss police reform. The public meeting was designed to give Black and Latinx residents a place to discuss their experiences, but it was quickly hijacked by white supremacists who flooded the screen with racial slurs, clips of KKK rallies, and other racist images. It's hard to imagine a more peaceful form of protest than an online town hall, and the fact that even this meeting was disrupted should make it obvious that some cries for people to protest racial injustice the right way are really just thinly veiled demands for oppressed people to stay quiet. The NCAA chapter wrote in a post after the event, "It's a shame that respectful dialogue cannot be engaged in without that portion of the population that believes people of color are less than. However, you know you're doing the right thing when people feel they have to disrupt your mission or resort to childish behavior as a way to upset your moment." Over to regional access news now. Let's see, Leah Toss writes from Raleigh, "Seizing a seat." Shanika Thomas doesn't have a daughter to dress in a green badge-covered Girl Scout vest. The 46-year-old, who serves as Director of Advocacy and Educational Partnerships for the NC Coastal Pines chapter, grew up in a family of Trinidadian immigrants, surrounded by strong women, but found herself raising two boys. That didn't stop her from seeking out ways to lift up women in the community, from her work as the first vice president of the Democratic Women of Wake County to her dedication to the Scouts. "I have 26,000 girls across 41 counties, Thomas says proudly. "Those are my girls." Thomas recently won the Wake County Democratic Party's nomination to be on the ballot this fall for the Wake County Board of Commissioners, replacing now Chair Greg Ford, where she will likely coast to victory this fall. A Republican hasn't served on the board since 2014. Meanwhile, former board chair Jessica Holmes, who was the youngest candidate ever elected to serve on the WCBC, hopes to make history again with her run for State Commissioner of Labor. If she wins, she'll be the first woman of color elected to the Council of State, along with State Representative Yvonne Hawley, who's vying for lieutenant governor. And just last week, the Raleigh City Council appointed attorney Stormy Forte to replace disgraced District D Councilor Sage Martin, who resigned last month amid allegations of sexual misconduct. It's a moment where these Black women are not just being chosen, but rather seizing their opportunity to take a seat at the table. Thomas says, "It's long overdue," meaning that Black women have always been there. "We've always been positioned. We've always been dedicated enough. We've always been capable. We've always had the desire. We've just never been selected that level and this mass a scale. We're more than capable, so I think it's time." Amid the backdrop of continued Black Lives Matter protests, the potential that these leaders could break glass ceilings through election or appointment is noteworthy, but none have been handed anything. Thomas and Forte went through an interview process and had to fight for their seats, bolstered, of course, by their long history of community service and involvement. And as Holly notes, when it comes to running for office, black women face an uphill battle, fundraising. She defeated State Senator Terry Van Dyne in the primary despite having raised $74,000 to Van Dyne's $489,000 in the first quarter of the year. She says, I won because I was the best qualified candidate and I happened to be a black woman. Money is not donated to us like it's donated to the others. We have to work a lot harder, a whole lot harder, to get funds to run our campaigns. We have also been known for making something out of nothing and making it. And everything isn't for sale, and everything isn't about money. When Holmes first ran for county office, she says she didn't see herself represented in local government. Should she win, her face will be displayed in every elevator in the state, sending a powerful message to women and girls of color. It's a pivotal moment, but more than that, an opportunity, Holmes said. She said, we as black women are recognizing not only the power of our vote, but the power of our voices at the table, and we are rising to the occasion. We're seizing opportunities that have long been denied to us for far too long. Denied to us because we didn't believe we belonged at the table. And now we are pushing the envelope, and we're not just marching. We're not just being the backbone of the Democratic Party, but we're stepping up to say we have earned this, we deserve it, and we will take our seat at that table. Still, the black community isn't a monolith. Stormy Fortas' nomination spurred some criticism from folks who worried she will side with the current council's pro-development agenda. But Fortin wasn't picked to pony up to Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. She's an attorney with a lengthy history of service in the community, political involvement, and advocacy, who won the endorsement on the strength of her detailed policy proposal and qualifications. Fort, who didn't return the Indy's request for comment, isn't just the first black woman to serve on the council. She's also the first person of color ever elected outside District C, and the council's first lesbian. I'm looking forward to serving the residents of District D as well as the residents of the city, Fort said at her swearing-in ceremony last week. While Holly was pleased with Fort's appointment, she says, I won't be satisfied until we win, until African-Americans win at the ballot box. That's what's important, she says. Now, a partnership in journalism, Riley Davis of the NC News Intern Corps writes, all that slithers from Durham. Got a snake in the grass? Call Nick, the snake guru. When Durham resident Barbara Dickinson found a snake trapped under the fence, she didn't post a for sale sign in her yard or kill it with a shovel. She went on the neighborhood app next door and contacted Nick, the snake guru. He arrived and easily removed the specimen, a harmless rat snake, from under the fence. The reptile seemed a little lethargic and dehydrated, so he took it home with him to recuperate for a few days. Nick Massimo is a herpetology Ph.D. student at Arizona State University who studies how infectious diseases affect amphibian populations. But many residents on Next Door know him as the Snake Guru or the Durham Snake Guy. Last year, he offered his snake expertise on the neighborhood social networking site. It kind of blew up, Massimo says. I got a ton of calls from people. Snake encounters appear to be on the rise this year, possibly due to more people completing home improvement projects or spending greater amounts of time outdoors during COVID-19. Wake Med Hospital in Raleigh has treated 73 snake bites from the beginning of the year through the month of June, says Senior Marketing and Communications Specialist Kristen Kelly, 50 of which occurred in May and June. That's up from 48 bites from January through June last year. She says, we do believe a lot of that is because people are spending more time outdoors, and even beyond COVID, just the growth of towns in general are encroaching on areas that typically had more natural space where the snakes were. Jeff Bean, herpetology collections manager at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh, said any increase in reported snake encounters probably results from changes in humans' behavior rather than an increase in the number of snakes. He says, I don't think there's been a year of my life when I haven't heard people go, oh, there's more snakes just this year than usual. That's never true. Bean added that while some hospital systems like WakeMed report the number of snake bites they treat, that doesn't necessarily represent a complete picture of snake interactions in the state. He says it's just really hard to get a lot of data. A lot of hospitals historically never kept that data. Some of them still don't keep it. Bean added that homeowners should take precautions when working around their yards or spending time outdoors, including wearing closed-toe shoes, not sticking their hands into wood piles or dark crevices, and carrying a flashlight at night. The more time you spend outside, the more likely you are to see a snake, he says. The more time you spend outside being careless, the more likely you are to be bitten by a snake. In Durham, Massimo generally gets anywhere from 1 to 7 calls or texts a week from people asking him to identify a snake, requesting he come remove it from a home or property, or simply asking for advice. Massimo says the majority of snake bites happen when someone who doesn't have experience tries to move an animal or kill a snake. That's why he volunteers to relocate them when leaving them be isn't an option, and to educate locals about the animal's ecological benefits. As a certified wildlife damage control agent with the state of North Carolina, Massimo is legally allowed to handle venomous snakes in addition to non-venomous species. In Durham, those are mainly copperheads that have wandered onto people's properties. Once captured, he relocates the snakes whenever he can. I'm trying to do everything possible that I can to aid the conservation of the species. However, per North Carolina law, he must release captured snakes onto properties where he's been given permission. This can sometimes prove tricky with venomous species. If Massimo can't find anyone willing to accept copperheads on their property, the state requires the snakes to be humanely euthanized. He says, I try to be 100% as transparent as possible with people. I always try to encourage people to live with the snakes. So if we can relocate them on their property, that's what I try to go for. While he mostly serves the Durham area, Massimo said he's happy to offer identifications or give advice to anyone who reaches out on Nextdoor. His services are free, although he accepts donations to help with his student expenses. And residents on the app are extremely appreciative of his services. In her post describing the rat snake's rescue, Dickinson added, "Hooray for Nick, who is a wonderful ambassador to the snake kingdom and to our entire community." And here are some snake tips from the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. 1. Clean up clutter. Remove hiding places like piles of rocks, woods, and other debris that attract rodents and snakes. Keep the lawn mowed. Snakes and their rodent prey prefer tall grasses where they can hide. They're also easier to spot in shorter grass. Discourage snakes from entering your home by closing gaps and holes, repairing damage to siding and the foundation, and scaling openings under doors, windows, and around water pipe. For more information on what to do when you encounter a snake, visit NCWRC's Snake Advice page. To Tomasi McDonald's column now from Durham, Keeping Vigil. Last year on August 18th, the shooting death of 9-year-old Zion Pearson shocked the conscience of a city where the murder of black men and boys by their peers is all too common an occurrence. As the Indy then reported, Zion's death served as an avatar of all that has gone wrong amid Durham's growth and prosperity. This month, the slaughter of the city's most vulnerable innocents continued when 10 people, including 3 children, were shot in a single night. One of the children, 12-year-old Tivian Ty McLean, died from a gunshot wound to the head. On July 15th, police announced 2 separate shootings in East and South Durham. It was just after 10:30 p.m. when officers arrived at a home in the 200 block of South Benjamin Street and discovered 8 people had been shot, including 2 children ages 4 and 8. It was about 4 hours later, just after 2:30 a.m., when officers responded to reports of gunfire at the Cornwallis Road housing complex in the 3000 block of Weaver Street. The investigators found two people had been wounded by gunfire when someone shot into a housing unit. An unnamed adult survived. Ty died 5 days later of his injuries. Zion was one of five kids riding in his aunt's Ford Escape for a late-night treat of snow cones when someone fired multiple gunshots into the vehicle. He was the quarterback on his championship-winning football team and was set to start fourth grade in the fall. Ty was attending a birthday party when he was struck by a bullet from warring factions shooting at each other. Those who knew him said he was always the life of the party, a jolly and loving sixth grader at Lowe's Grove Middle School. Coretta Saunders, his godmother, said, "It pisses me off." She said that during a vigil for the child that was sponsored by the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham at CCB Plaza. She asked, "If we can't protect this generation, how are we going to have one later? Black lives matter, but what about Ty's life? We need to be yelling, kids' life matters." Public housing activist Ashley Kennedy said, "Residents need to stop protecting gun criminals. Y'all protecting the shooters more than you're protecting the kids," she said. "If they're in your house, get them out. Don't tell Ty's mom you love her and the shooters are sitting in your house eating." The child's mother, Tamisha McLean, wore a T-shirt with a picture of her son. She said, "Ty was energetic and strong like an ox. Everyone who met him was his friend," she said with a smile. "Ty, you are loved. I am loved. We are loved. You are, excuse my French, a hell of a fighter." Among the nearly 60 people who attended the vigil was Durham County Commissioner Brenda Howerton, who lost two sons to gun violence in the 1990s. "Mom," Howerton said to Ty's mother, "I feel your pain, and I am so sorry. This community owes you better than this." Howerton told the vigil-goers systemic racism plays a role in creating impoverished communities where young people resort to gangs and violence without creative outlets and opportunities. "But we cannot take it out on each other," she said. "We have to give each other love." Police have not yet made an arrest in the shootings that killed Ty, but one day after the child was shot, Durham County Sheriff's deputies searched a home in the 800 block of North Briggs Avenue where residents were suspected of drug and firearms trafficking. The deputies recovered stolen handguns, heroin, cocaine, marijuana, and cash. Deputies charged a 20-year-old man, describing a sheriff's press release as a validated gang member, and an 18-year-old woman for multiple drug and weapons violations. The raid occurred less than a mile from South Benjamin Street, where two children were shot the night before. Police have not released a motive for the shootings that killed Ty, but Burkhead pointed to a deadly nexus of gangs, drugs, and guns that fuel much of the city's violence. Ty's vigil ended just before 7 p.m. when his friends and family counted to 12 and released helium-filled balloons in the air to honor his memory. "Rest in peace, Ty," they said in unison. One bundle of balloons got tangled in tree branches near Corcoran Square. "That's him," one vigil goer shouted. "He's still here." A cover story from Indie Week this week is called Unpacking the Hotspots. It's by Sandy Smith-Nonini and Tim Marima. We came to know the coronavirus last spring from nightly news of New York City's urban crisis. But in June, so-called embers of hidden infections morphed into wildfires, sweeping across large swaths of rural North Carolina and other states, leaving families and communities with upended lives and ongoing risk. While nursing homes and prisons made up most rural hotspots in the spring, growing evidence now points to a different major engine of spread that has lurked beneath the radar of public awareness and official recognition: meat processing. By mid-May, as if to complement North Carolina's rank as a pork and poultry producer, our state was the national leader in COVID-19 outbreaks at meatpacking plants, according to the Food and Environment Reporting Network, called FERN. At least 3,200 meatpacking workers have contracted the coronavirus in outbreaks at 37 plants as of July 24, according to the State Department of Health and Human Services. But spread that begins in the plant doesn't stay in the plant. In mid-June, the News and Observer reported that zip codes close to plants showed a rise in cases since May the 1st that was 600% higher than the state average. Our data verify that such viral spread continues. Below, we connect the dots between North Carolina's ongoing community spread and meatpacking plants to demonstrate the need for enforceable safety regulations and transparent reporting of data to bring the contagion under control. Let's start with a quandary. High case rates, total cases adjusted for population, are typically found in cities. So why does Duplin County have the highest case rate in the state at 309 per 10,000 residents, close to twice the rate for populous Mecklenburg County, 168 out of 10,000? Duplin is now national class in the dubious category of coronavirus infections, recently ranking 58th in a New York Times listing of the 100 U.S. counties with the most serious surges. A disease detective, a.k.a. an epidemiologist, would look for a point source of spread, a prison or an elder care facility. Data on such settings are routinely collected by the state, but a recent count of roughly 183 such cases in Duplin explain only a tenth of the 1,820 cases recorded in the county since as of July 24th. The rash of meatpacking plants across southern counties, five in Duplin alone, is a vital clue. At least two Duplin plants have confirmed outbreaks, including the Butterball Turkey plant near Mount Olive and the Villari Foods Pork Company plant in Warsaw. We mapped the two clusters of rural North Carolina zip codes with high case rates, that's 100 or more cases per 10,000 residents, that are within commuting distance of one or more meat processing plants. And, of course, I cannot interpret the chart for you without taking the rest of our time, so I'll just have to read what they say. The Southeast Cluster, is the regional epicenter of the industry, includes Duplin, Northern Robeson, and portions of Cumberland, Sampson, Johnston, Bladen, and Lenoir counties. This density of plants correlates with risk. 14 zip codes with case rates over 200 in this cluster have two or more plants within 15 miles. Figure 2, our central cluster, extends across Lee, Chatham, Montgomery, and portions of Randolph and Stanley counties. These zip codes are less contiguous than in the southeast because our rural-focused analysis meant leaving out the cities of Sanford and Ashboro, whose populations exceed our limit of 25,000. 25 of the 41 zip codes with high infection rates in these two clusters have a high number of Hispanic residents, 17% to 50% compared to the state average of 10%. 14 zip codes, all in the southeast, have a relatively high African American population, 28% to 47% compared to the state average of 22%. There's also a Native American presence in Robeson County. These high Hispanic and minority communities align with the demographics of meatpacking workers. Statewide, Hispanics constitute a disproportionate number of COVID-19 cases, 42%, while deaths from the virus disproportionately affect African Americans, 33%, in part due to both groups being overrepresented in essential high-risk jobs, as well as the chronic health problems that have long plagued Black communities. While elderly people are the bulk of those dying of the virus, 75% of cases are among people of working age between 18 and 64. Younger cohorts have been testing positive since June. Since many minority families live in crowded, multi-generational households, elderly relatives are at risk when workers are infected at work. Likewise, community spread occurs as they go about daily life, shopping for food, banking, sharing carpools with co-workers. Few meatpacking plants have confirmed reports of outbreaks, and North Carolina's DHHS will not identify which plants have cases. but state health officials confirmed by email on July the 24th that 27 such outbreaks remain active in 20 counties, including 8 represented in these clusters. Outbreaks have occurred in 6 plants in the southeast and cluster, including 2 Duplin plants above, plus 2 Smithfield food plants, Tar Heel and Clinton, Mount Air, Lumber Bridge, and Sanderson Farms, St. Paul's, according to media accounts. 2 outbreaks have been reported in the central cluster at the Mount Air plant, Siler City, and Pilgrim's Pride plant in Sanford. The June surge in urban cases is often attributed to reopening of the economy, but the steep rise in cases for predominantly rural Robeson and Duplin showed no deviations that lined up with the state's reopening on May 8th for Phase 1 and May 22nd for Phase 2. Both counties saw new infections shoot up an alarming 45-fold in the 2 months ending on June 10. Although news coverage on most plant outbreaks peaked in April and early May, the steady weekly rise in case numbers since then in this rural area suggests that outbreaks and community spread continue in the southeast. This conclusion is supported by a survey of 36 worker complaints to Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, about unsafe conditions in plants between April and early June, and reports from workers and rural nonprofits of worker families falling ill. North Carolina's DHHS boosted testing in July, so high case rates partly reflect hidden infections coming to light when more convenient free testing is offered in rural areas. But since asymptomatic people often test negative roughly 2 weeks after being infected, this steady rise in cases over 6 weeks is consistent with ongoing spread. Our state's experience is not unique. As of July 23rd, at least 37,000 meatpacking workers had tested positive for the virus in 38 states, and 168 have died, reported Fern, F-E-R-N. Community spread from industry outbreaks is also common. In late May, the nonprofit found that rural counties with previous meatpacking outbreaks showed infection rates 5 times higher than the average for other U.S. rural counties. Multinationals such as Tyson, JBS, and Smithfield accounted for more than half of meatpacking cases nationwide. After initial outbreaks closed about 25 plants across the country by late April, Tyson Foods lobbied the White House and placed ads in major papers warning of a meat shortage. The industry was rewarded by an executive order from President Donald Trump a day later requiring plants to stay open. Since then, many companies have adopted temperature checks of workers, masks, and gloves, that personal PPE, and installed hand-washing station and dividers between line workers. The large Smithfield Foods plant with more than 4,000 workers in Tar Heels is one of the rare unionized plants in the state. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union credits Smithfield for new safety protocols, as well as paid sick leave for infected workers and those over age 60. But complaints to OSHA, including 6 from workers in that plant, tell a more nuanced story. Several said social distancing was lacking, and one described employees working elbow to elbow. On May 6, the worker wrote, "Numbers of cases have gone up. Management has not provided any PPE or any cleaning to protect workers." Scott Mabry, a spokesperson for NC OSHA, said the agency has received 75 meatpacking complaints since March, including 7 in July. He said OSHA sends letters and follows up with employers, but has not done inspections related to meatpacking complaints to date. At the Siler City Mount Air plant, 6 to 8 weeks passed before safety protocols were implemented, said Ilana Dubister of Hispanic Liaison. Although companies are supposed to inform workers exposed to employees who test positive, workers told her Mount Air would not give out this information. As a result, some took on the task of contact tracing themselves. They also said infected workers say supervisors pressure them to come back to work, a practice criticized in OSHA filings from workers for that plant, as well as the Montair plant in Lumber Bridge and the Smithfield plant in Wilson. The practice flies in the face of the widely accepted two-week quarantine for people exposed to COVID-19, since even asymptomatic people can transmit the virus. But it is allowed in workplace guidelines the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, and OSHA published in April. The Denver Post obtained emails revealing the weaker rule was adopted within hours after JBS asked Vice President Mike Pence to intervene. Pence called Robert Redfield, director of the CDC, asking him to amend the guidelines then in preparation, permitting workers to test positive who test positive to resume work if they are asymptomatic. The guidelines have also been criticized for merely offering advice rather than rules. Debbie Berkowitz, a former OSHA chief of staff, said the language is so watered down with phrases like if feasible and consider doing this, they're essentially unenforceable. To protect the public from COVID-19, you have to protect workers. If you don't, it continues to spread. So in this pandemic, worker health is public health, says Berkowitz, a worker safety specialist at the National Employment Law Project. In public statements, plant managers often cite culture to explain high Hispanic infection rate. At a recent town hall meeting, Senator Tom Tillis speculated that Hispanics' people rejection of masks was the problem, although surveys show that Hispanics accept masks at a higher rate than whites. One might also point to culture when plants with large numbers of immigrant employees fail to publish COVID safety rules in their native language, a problem the CDC found to be common in meatpacking plants that experienced outbreaks. Some states, including Michigan, Minnesota, and Illinois, have responded to outbreaks in meat plants by issuing regulations specifically targeted at meatpacking, Berkowitz says. Several others, including Virginia, adopted enforceable regulations that apply to all workplaces, but North Carolina is going in the opposite direction. In early July, several lawmakers proposed linking worker safety measures and paid medical leaves to state grants intended to aid small and medium-sized meat packers in the crisis, but their amendments were voted down. In the end, Republican lawmakers voted to give $10 million in grants to the companies and livestock producers with no requirements other than to submit a safety plan. Representative Jimmy Dixon, a Duplin County Republican who opposed the amendments, said the plants could be trusted more than lawmakers on how to keep employees safe. Well, next we'll talk about the cultural segments of the Indie Week, and I'll go first to a review of a movie called The Fight, and the review is by Glenn McDonald. Staking Liberties, it's called. An ambitious documentary with a real emotional punch, The Fight chronicles four high-profile legal cases recently pursued by the ACLU, a tenacious nonprofit dedicated to defending civil liberties in the United States. Each case directly or indirectly targets the federal government, and each is a suspenseful legal thriller in its own right. This movie is designed to get your blood up. And so it does. The cases under scrutiny are among the more than 140 lawsuits the ACLU has filed against the Trump administration since 2017. Veteran immigration lawyer Lee Gelernt leads the most compelling storyline, which deals with the brutal family separation policies at the border. The other lawsuits involve abortion access, the military's ban on transgender people, and the immigration question on the 2020 census. Amid the legal drama, we get to know several overtaxed ACLU lawyers who are fighting on the front lines. Gelernt works through his young son's Saturday birthday so that other parents will be able to reunite with their children. We also spend some time with ACLU clients. We meet a rape victim denied an abortion by immigration officials, a dedicated Navy officer who is about to lose his job, and a desperate mom separated from her child. The directing team employs the traditional blend of interview segments and archival materials, plus some stylish animation sequences. The best moments, however, are the handheld verite scenes, in which plans go haywire, triumphs are celebrated, and decisions are handed down. The film folds in moments of gentle humor, too, including a running gag about recalcitrant ergonomic desks at ACLU headquarters. This movie is very engaging and more than a little scary. It makes a persuasive case that the U.S. is a lot closer than you might think to a Handmaid's Tale-style dystopia. The ACLU provides a thin membrane of protection against a reactionary cancer spreading through our government and society. ACLU lawyer David Ho says in the closing scenes, "We're not going to be able to stop this thing ourselves. We're 2.5 floors in a New York building against the power of the federal government and a massive political movement. It's not going to be lawyers in courts. It's going to be people who turn this ship around." Now, The Fight is available Friday through various online services, or you can support your local theater by purchasing tickets via the Carolina Theater website at carolinatheater.org. And moving on to another article by Brian Howe, "The Many Lives of Jabari Hayes as Seen in the BLK Docs Virtual Festival." In his memoir, Miles in the Life, Jabari Hayes recounts growing up surrounded by crack cocaine in a Brooklyn public housing project, becoming a high school track star in St. Louis, and then starting his own valet business in Atlanta after graduating from an HBCU there. But origins have a powerful pull, and Hayes ended up using his business to traffic cocaine across the country for the Black Mafia family, said to be the largest African-American drug organization until federal prosecution brought it down in the mid-2000s. Parentheses, if you bought a fabulous Young Jeezy or other BFMF entertainment album before then, you helped it launder money. Director Sean Mathis chronicles all that, and the life Hayes found on the other side in his documentary of the same name, which is screening virtually for 1 week in the new BLK Docs series. Founded by the Durham studio Speller Street Films and the Brooklyn series The Luminal Theater, in partnership with the film crowdfunding site Seed and Spark, the series aims to, quote, build an authentic documentary film culture within the African-American community through monthly screenings, classes, and webinars. It began last month with Wilmington on Fire, Christopher Everett's documentary about the white supremacist massacre and coup in the North Carolina beach town in 1898. Miles in the Life is available to watch at the time of your choosing from July 30 to August 6. Tickets are $5, and there are also free live events such as a Q&A with Hayes and Mathis at 8 p.m. Thursday, July the 30th. That's tonight. Visit blkdocs.com to learn more and watch. From Art, Sarah Edwards' column is titled Stolen Thunder. In early June, in the wake of George Floyd's murder and the national Black Lives Matter protests, black artists began painting murals on the boarded-up windows of downtown Durham. Organized in part by the North Star Church of the Arts and the local arts equity advocates of Art Ain't Innocent, the murals were created in tandem with national public art responses to Black Lives Matter. Weeks after the murals went up, John Davis, a white photographer in Durham, began taking pictures of them. Without consulting the artists, he compiled images of the work of more than a dozen artists into a book that he titled All/Black Lives Matter, which evokes the anti-black All Lives Matter slogan. Wade H. Williams, whose mural art was used on Davis's business card, says, "One thing that really upset me was the title of the book. I feel that slash is John Davis projecting his white privilege without even thinking about who I am or what the work is really all about. Once we get to a point where black lives matter, then and only then will all lives matter. Davis told the Indy over the phone, BLM is what it is. I thought it was important to be inclusive and to say we're all in this together. He says he only made 7 or 8 copies of the book, which might have gone unnoticed had the downtown bar Luella Wine, Beer, and Beverage not promoted it in an Instagram post on July 18th, stating it was, quote, a beautiful way to save those works of art. The post set into motion a week of pushback from community members who recognized the artwork and flooded the Luella Instagram with comments. They also reached out to the bar and Davis to voice concern about the book, calling it theft and invoking the hashtag #PayBackArtists. Initially, Davis was unresponsive to the pushback. You put art up in the street and walk away from it, it's up for grabs, he told the Indy. He also said that he had responded to an email from Laura Ritchie, a member of the collective Art Ain't Innocent, but had otherwise not engaged with black artists or community members who had reached out. Davis said he sold 3 books for $50 each, not $75 as originally advertised, gave one away, and destroyed the rest. He wrote in the follow-up text, I didn't make the fortune I'm being accused of. Profit, though, was only one of the issues at the heart of the controversy. The artists that the Indy spoke with expressed frustration over seeing their work, a loving and intentional response to the events of Black Lives Matter, co-opted by a white person who showed no interest in researching the movement or having a dialogue with the artists. Some were also concerned with the way the book portrays the murals as a creative flashpoint rather than an organized effort that centers black agency. Davis wrote in the intro, a group of talented and creative local Durham artists emerged spontaneously to decorate these boards with amazing artwork never seen before, likely never to be seen again. As businesses began to reopen, the boards and artwork began to disappear. Marcella Camara, one of the muralists, points out that the murals have been relocated and that the artist paid for a black photographer to document and preserve the work. Camara says, I remember in college organizing with the NAACP, and Tim Tyson was one of our mentors. And he said, if someone describes something as a spontaneous moment, they probably just don't know anybody in the community. On July 24, after mounting community pressure, Davis donated the $150 he'd made from the book to the Durham Artist Relief Fund. The artists involved are having conversations this week about how the money will be used. Davis told the Indy, sounding wounded, I don't want it to be an us versus them thing. In an email to Laura Ritchie, though, his tone had a different edge. Please, he wrote to Ritchie, tell your people to back off. And I have time for at least one music review as well. This one written again by Brian Howe called Lifted Voices. And it's about Y Oak, W-Y-E Oak. I mean, really, at this point, what kind of music does Y Oak even make? Looking back at my writings on them, which have been plentiful since Jen Wozner and Andy Stack left Baltimore to join their longtime label in Durham, I see that I've tried out dream pop and synth pop, art rock and electro rock, always capturing part of the sound but never the whole. With each release, it's only getting harder. No Horizon, the EP that comes out July 31 on Merge Records, is a collaboration with the Brooklyn Youth Chorus that pushes Y Oak into unknown territory. But instead of getting lost out there, they retrieved a suite of music that's completely what it is, with hardly a redundant moment, rising to the glittering heights of last fall's single, Fortune. Ever since the pivotal 2018 album, The Louder I Call, The Faster It Runs, Y Oak's music has been easier to describe with traits than categories. It's minimal, yet majestic, experimental, yet melodic, with massive basses, pressurized percussion, sculptural guitars and synths, and centerpiece vocals. In short, the kind of arty indie rock that has a credible path to Grammy consideration. This is a world the young folks in the Brooklyn Youth Chorus know well. Distinguished in classical music, the group is also a growing concern in popular music, appearing on some of the biggest indie Your Dad Knows records of recent years. The Nationals' I Am Easy to Find, Bon Iver's I, Grizzly Bear's The Cottonist. They first connected with White Oaks when both groups performed on William Britell's 2019 pop classical hybrid Spiritual America, and then kept collaborating on their own. White Oak wrote a commission for the chorus, resulting in this EP, which premiered at the Ecstatic Music Festival in New York in early 2019. All the White Oak traits are intact. AEIOU has that rangy bounce they've perfected, dramatic and relaxed at once. The song chugs and chimes as usual, yet the choir turns it into marching orders for jubilant angels learning their letters at angel school. The vowels they scatter are a perfect frame for Wassenaar's singing, which always seems to consist solely of round flowing vowels, ungated by consonants. In No Place, they swap places. Wassenaar casts spoken echoes into the choir's wind-swept lead over a consummately modern groove that nevertheless suggests the figured bass of a Baroque classical piece. Spitting Image makes some finger-cramping time signature feel fresh and natural, like music for skipping through puddles while it rains in the sun. There's no good reason for Cloud, a minute of guitar and synth warbles, to be here, but it doesn't hurt. And the EP regains its unerring instinct with Sky Witness, a canyon-wide conclusion where the voices of Wassenaar and the Brooklyn Youth Chorus finally join in unison. As the trees tap out messages in code, the lyrics concern the connection between words and the world that shapes the whole EP, which has an artistic amplitude more like the kind of art music composer Pitchfork might write about. Think Caroline Shaw, Shara Nova, and Nico Muley, all of whom, of course, have worked with the Brooklyn Youth Chorus, than any species of rock. I mentioned the music being completely what it is, but what's truly remarkable is that White Oak itself, through experimentation, collaboration, and ambition after 15 years, is coming into that kind of uncanny focus, too. And Mr. Howe's review gives White Oak No Horizon 4.5 stars out of 5. And again, that's to be released July the 31st. As much as time as I have left, another music article by Spencer Griffith called Cover Story. Quote, I started thinking, wow, is there even going to be a Cat's Cradle to come back to when this is all behind us? What will happen to these venues that launch and sustain local music and make this town what it is? Like many musicians and music lovers, singer-songwriter and UNC Chapel Hill English professor Florence Dorr was flooded with what-if questions when COVID caused live music to grind to a halt in mid-March, shuttering the venerable Carborough venue, which just celebrated its 50th anniversary and its many peers in the Triangle. Dorr had been working on a new album and touring, but when the pandemic struck, she felt a sudden urgency to record a Marshall Crenshaw tune that guitarist Pete Holsapple suggested her band should cover. The early days of quarantine were so terrifying, and Somewhere Down the Line is all about reassurance in a moment of crisis, she says. Like a lot of songs, it took on new meaning. Dorr decided to recruit other artists to record their own quarantine covers for a compilation. The result? The album Cover Charge, where prominent local acts cover favorite songs, with proceeds helping to sustain the Cradle and its employees. With the help of the Splinter Group, Dorr landed a wide variety of Triangle musicians who have played at the Cradle over the decades, from the old guard to newer stars. The last 5 of the 25 tracks will be released Friday, July 31st, as a Bandcamp exclusive, which you can purchase the album for $25. Funds will help cover the rent, utilities, insurance, loan payments, and other overhead expenses, according to the Cradle owner, Frank Heath. He says nobody plans for a 10 to 18 month total interruption in business. Appropriately, Appropriately, the collection vacillates between hope and longing. Superchunk sprints out of the gate with a turbocharged take on the Go-Go's Can't Stop the World, characteristically defiant and brimming with confidence that the pandemic can't hold listeners or the cradle down. Sarah Shook and the Disarmers, followed by transforming a yearning cigarettes after sex song, Apocalypse, from dreamy indie pop to tear-jerking twang. H.C. McIntyre's band Mount Moriah brings a plucky spirit to an unearthed recording of Neil Young's Don't Let It Bring You Down, while Skylar Goodash and Archers of Loaf's Eric Bachman team for a sublime duet on the Everly Brothers' All I Have to Do Is Dream. There are more humorous perspectives, too, such as the Connells' Keep Your Distance and the DBs' I'm on an Island. And there are fond odes to touring and tourmates. Iron and Wine covers Piss Diary by Chapel Hill's The Kingsbury Manx, who were Sam Beam's first contact with the Triangle before moving here, thanks to a tour in 2002. There are adventurous choices that largely connect. The Felt uses a shimmering wall of guitars to turn Madonna's Dress You Up into a shoegaze anthem, and the Mountain Goat's metal-loving John Darnielle retains the foreboding feel of Paradise Lost's The Longest Winter while swapping doomy guitars for piano. Others stick to their wheelhouse, though the results are hardly disappointing. Mandolin Orange finally gives us a gorgeous studio version of longtime live staple Boots of Spanish Leather, while the rollicking, bluesy Traveling in Style feels tailor-made for His Golden Messenger and Jonathan Wilson. But the highlight is Faith Jones's swampy, soulful rendition of For What It's Worth, which broadens the focus from the pandemic to the summer of live Black Lives Matter protests. Jones says it brings a really important perspective to the album because all of this stuff with the quarantine goes hand in hand with issues that black people have been facing for centuries in this country. She was in Doors' songwriting course last fall and tracked her vocals while finishing her music degree at UNC this summer. Producer Chris Stamey, whose fingerprints are all over the compilation, originally suggested the Buffalo Springfield classic and later proposed that Jones incorporate an Angela Davis quote that had been her email signature for years in the coda. Well, unfortunately, I gotta go. But the ncreadingservice.org offers this Indie Week issue for a week in our podcast section. Reading for our blind and print-impaired listeners, John Fetterson wishes you all well until our next program.